My name is Curtis Croft. I am 63 years of age. Today is Saturday, December 14th, 2019, and I'm currently in Yuma, Arizona. The person interviewing me today will be Courtney Gilbert.
Thank you, Curtis. My name is Courtney Gilbert. I'm 28 years old. Today is Saturday, December 14th, 2019. I am with Curtis in Yuma, Arizona. I'm going to be talking with Curtis, interviewing Curtis. We're going to be new friends after this, I feel like. So you have such a unique kind of perspective and narrative. Let's get right into it. Can you tell me where you started your life and where you began your journey?
I was born on July 21st, 1956, 12 days after the birth of Tom Hanks.
Okay.
Tom Hanks was born in Southern California, and I was born in Northern California, in the city of Eureka, which is right on the ocean.
The goal.
and it's in Humboldt County.
Okay.
My father owned a liquor business there that wasn't very successful, and it wasn't very conducive to raising a family of three children. So his sister, who was living in San Bernardino County, mm-hmm. encouraged him to come down and take advantage of the housing boom that was going on in the Palm Springs and the other desert areas.
That big sister wisdom.
So he packed up his family and moved to San Bernardino and got a position as a plumber. The thing to remember about San Bernardino is that San Bernardino County is the largest county in the United States. West Virginia can comfortably fit on the inside of it, or 15 Rhode Islands.
Wow.
It's also the home of the largest Marine Corps base in the United States, 29 Palms Marine Base.
Wow.
And it's also the center of the universe.
The center of the universe has a specific kind of influence in your life. Unpack that.
Okay. It's influenced a lot of people. The list of musicians that I gave you all have a connection to Joshua Tree. There are a lot of the center of the universe aspects about Joshua Tree.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, as a five-year-old child, it was the intersection of two roads. And at that road was the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
My father had rented a ranch. Now, when you think of a ranch, you think of horses and cows. But it wasn't that kind of a ranch. The best word that describes it is a Hollywood cowboy dude ranch.
Okay.
In the 1950s, Gene Autry chose to go to a place above Yucca Valley in San Bernardino County and formed a place called Pioneer Town.
Pioneer Town.
And it was built by a man by the name of Dick Curtis.
Okay.
And so what he did is said, I can build this set for cowboy movies to be made for the theater and television, because television was that brand new enterprise that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So Gene Autry called his friend Roy Rogers. Now, Roy Rogers also lives in San Bernardino County in an area called Apple Valley, whereas Palm Springs is not in San Bernardino County.
Okay.
So they came there and they filmed these movies. Well, Roy Rogers flew back to Apple Valley. Gene Autry flew down to Palm Springs.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the people in charge of the horses, the people who built the sets, the people who ran the cameras?
Absolutely.
Where do they go?
Yeah.
They don't have a plane.
No.
And it's a pretty rugged ride from Yucca Valley down to Palm Springs. So they had to go to someplace.
Mm-hmm.
It is my belief, and I have no paper trail, no work, other than a couple of speculations,
mm-hmm.
that the ranch that I lived on from the age of 5 to 12
mm-hmm.
was a former place where the people who worked for Roy Rogers and Gene Autry hung
out. Yeah, the crew.
This ranch had four buildings on it. It had an original adobe house made out of adobe brick, and it was plastered with plaster, and it was very old. The kitchen and the bathroom were added onto it later because the adobe house was built up,
mm-hmm.
and the kitchen and bathroom were on the ground level. It had two bunk houses. One bunk house had a musical stage and a dance floor on the bottom.
Oh, my goodness.
And on the top was the bunk beds, to where you could just sleep for the night or just, you know, hang out for the next filming. The other bunk house was like an atrium, or here in Yuma, they're called Arizona rooms. It was all windows, and it was up high, so you could have a good view of all the area around you. Underneath it was a basement that was made out of flagstone rock, and it went in really deep. As a child, I remember it being very cold, It held my dad's abalone diving outfit from Northern California, and it was useless out in the desert. But as a child, I was fascinated by the swim fins
of
and the
course,
mask
yeah.
because you can't use it out in the desert. And then it held canned goods. My parents loved to can corn, salsa, peaches, and then this weird thing called mincemeat. They just loved mincemeat and had to can it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the restaurant. The restaurant had a bar that was made out of mahogany and had a surround around the bar of this massive bamboo. This bar is bigger than most people's front rooms that they have today. And on the kickboard part of the bar are four panels that were hand-painted of a forest. The first panel showed all these trees.
That's so dynamic.
And the second panel showed this guy fishing out into this big lake with snow-capped mountains behind it. The third panel showed a dock with a boat and a cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth panel showed waterfalls coming down.
Wow.
Yeah, wow, because as a child in the middle of the desert,
yeah.
where does this place exist
yeah.
on Earth? I would spend a lot of time looking at that.
It seems so magical, and I'm in agreement with your conjecture that this was obviously a place for production and creation. It's just so fantastic.
Well, the evidence gets stronger.
Let's go.
Okay. In 1963, there was a movie film called It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World.
Mm-hmm.
It was Spencer Tracy's next to last movie.
It's one of my mom's favorites. Yeah.
Well, Spencer Tracy holds a record with someone else as being the only actor to win two consecutive Oscars. The other actor being Tom Hanks. In the movie is Ethel Merman
mm-hmm.
and Milton Berle mm-hmm. and a whole wide of ensemble of comedians. Just a really fun movie.
Amazing movie. Very
well,
fun.
In that role, Ethel Merman and Milton Berle, Ethel Merman is the mother-in-law
mm-hmm.
and Milton Berle is the son-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the censors would not allow Milton Berle to put his hand down the cleavage of Ethel Merman to get the keys because in the movie, she had gotten mad and had put the keys down her dress.
Mm-hmm.
So the censor said, let's turn her upside down and shake the keys out. Now, Ethel Merman is a very famous actress, and you don't turn her upside down.
Yeah.
So you need a stunt double to come
yeah.
and do that. The stunt double for Ethel Merman was the owner of the ranch that I lived on.
Oh, my goodness.
So while she was filming, her husband came out and visited us and told us about the movie. And this particular scene was being shot in Yucca Valley in front of the Bowling Alley.
Mm-hmm.
If one watches the movie, you can just barely see the Bowling Alley that still stands and the back of Ethel Merman, my landlord, being shaken upside down.
Your landlord. An amazing connection there.
Well, her husband was a stand-in on Gunsmoke. He played
oh, wow.
bit parts on Gunsmoke, and he was also the stand-in for the bartender. So our landlords had some kind of connection to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And they had some way of getting a hold of this ranch.
Yeah.
So that is my evidence that at one time was a Hollywood
something.
Something.
Something, at least for those folks and those characters and those crew members to be and to have space. It's also very functional when you talk about the bunk area, you know. How many houses are incorporating stages, you know, as a part of their design and living spaces. So I think that's just very unique. So did you have any specific influence with movies and music? Did you pursue theater and creating as you got older?
Well, because I was the largest kid in elementary school, I got all the starting parts in the school plays at the Joshua Tree Elementary School.
Yeah.
Because my voice was loud. I had a good way of memorizing the nature of the narrative of the story. So
mm-hmm.
it was no problem.
Took to it.
When I was in high school, I was in one play. And then when I went to college, my girlfriend's sister was a drama major, and she was looking for actors to be in her traveling children's play, which was The Wizard of Oz.
Wow.
So I got to play the guard.
Okay.
So, yeah, I ended up being an actor, but I don't think that had that much of an influence. I was a kid.
Yeah.
And there was just so much to explore around the ranch that, you know, I just never got into acting.
What other kind of memories stand out for you in this space, in the center of the universe for you?
So the center of the universe was two roads that went nowhere. One went north into the southern boundaries of the Marine base, and it went south to the Joshua Tree National Park. The other part dead ended into Copper Mountain, which is now a community college. But when I was a kid, it was just a massive dry lake bed that when it rained a lot, it'd have water. And then the other side of the road ended into the northern boundaries of Joshua Tree. So the roads went nowhere. But on that intersection, I could see everywhere. And in the month of May, I would go out and look for tortoises, for tortoises to cross the road.
Wow.
Because in my memory, I could be wrong about the dates, but I think it was the first weekend in May that the village of Joshua Tree had tortoise races.
Wow.
And that was the big event. The tortoise races took place at the Sportsman Hall, which served as a community kind of hub for activities. They used to do a Christmas pageant on the hillside right below our elementary school, where we'd hear the story of Jesus during Christmas, and we would park in the parking lot, and they'd have loudspeakers, and they would narrate the story. And then as people went up the hill, they would turn the floodlights on. So it would start with Mary and Gabriel, go to the Romans, go to the manger, and you'd hear the story. And so this is where they developed the Joshua Tree turtle races right above our elementary school. So in the first week of May, during recess and during lunch recess, all of his kids would go running out to the chain link fence that prevented us from tumbling down the hill. And we'd be sitting there watching it get ready for this carnival.
Yeah.
They would bring in food booths and pretty games, and then they would bring in four rides. They'd bring in the Tilt-A-Whirl.
Of course.
The Scrambler, a Ferris wheel, a little tiny helicopter ride, and then the octopus. The scariest ride of all. The double dog dare you kind of ride. I just dare you to get on it. It looked really scary. Wasn't something that I really wanted to do.
I'm imagining lots of like arms, obviously, and then some kind of like vertical and horizontal twisting.
Right.
Okay.
And at the end of those arms were little pods that you would sit in.
Oh.
So finally, I got the nerve to get into it. I have no idea who is seated next to me. It wasn't a classmate of mine. It was probably somebody from 29 Palms or Yucca Valley. And the ride would kind of go ground level to get everybody seated. And then up you go. And then it would slowly tilt in the air to where one pod would be high on the arch.
Yeah.
And another pod would be on the low.
Oh.
And around and around and it stopped with me at the highest point of the arch.
Been there.
Hanging upside down, looking at the sky, wondering how soon it was before I was going to die. As an 8-year-old child, that was very discerning. And to this day, it prevents me from going on the scary rides at state fairs.
It's enough. Yeah.
So it was an exciting event.
Yeah.
And the whole purpose of the race was to race tortoises. So at the center of the universe, I would find these tortoises crossing the dirt roads. And I would run down and I would pick them up.
Okay. No bait, just going for it.
Well, they're moving so slow, you pick them up. But there was a problem with picking up a tortoise.
Okay.
That if you held it, if you're like 8, 9 years old and you got to hold a big tortoise next to your body, they relieve their bladder.
Oh, wow.
Because now they are in extensive fear.
Yeah.
They are in distress.
Yeah.
And one of the things they do is relieve their bladder and dehydrate themselves. And they would eliminate most of the fluid out of their body.
Yeah.
As an 8-year-old and my parents, ecology, the word ecology hadn't even been invented in the 60s. They had no idea what we were doing.
Yeah.
So I would pick this tortoise up, take it back to the ranch. Now we had a wading pool to where the cowboys could take their boots off and put their feet in to get their feet soaked. And we put the tortoises in that. And then my dad would put a piece of plywood over it for shade, some water. And then my mom would give them a non-nutritionist iceberg lettuce. So I was allowed to collect 5 tortoises.
Yeah.
And so while the tortoises are in this cement pool, they're in distress. They're sand, but they're clawing at trying to get out. And they're burning up their body fat. And they're putting themselves in an amount of distress.
Aww.
I was not the only child or adult doing this. Everyone was doing this in the 60s.
Because there's a distinction between tortoises and turtles, right?
Well, the turtle was just a name that everybody was familiar with, but it was actually tortoises that we were racing.
Yeah.
But it's easier to say Joshua Tree turtle races as opposed to tortoise races. So they're called tortoises.
And the tortoises can't go in water,
no,
right?
No.
They
okay,
can't go in the water. Yeah.
No. So my dad would allow me to pick out the best tortoise that I had been training and watching to see how fast they would go.
Yeah.
And then I'd take that tortoise.
And
like every
it.
Other child and adult, we'd go down to the Sportsman Hall complex and they'd put a number on the back of that tortoise.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would pay a fee, which in today's monetary value is probably in the $5 to $7 range.
Okay.
So it was like a form of gambling
mm.
to see if your horse would, to see if your horse would make it. So in this case, it's a tortoise.
Yeah.
So we'd carry it out to a big circle cage that was in the middle of left field. So between the pitcher's base and left field, they
okay.
drew this large chalk circle.
Okay.
And then they put a cage in the middle of it, and you put your tortoise inside that cage. And then they would pull the lever on the cage, and the cage would move into the air, and the tortoises would take off.
Yeah.
Or just sit there. Whatever was the tortoise's concept of what to do for that day.
Right.
And then there were grown men around the circle, and then they
I can imagine cheering and trying to coax the tortoises to move.
Probably. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I just remember trying to look for my tortoise to cross
yeah.
the line. And then once they crossed the line, the men would signal first tortoise, second tortoise, and third tortoise, because only three tortoises paid out monetary rewards.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the beauty of living in Joshua Tree was these tortoise races.
It sounds like a distinctly kind of unique to the place where it's at kind of activity.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
But after doing that for years and years and years, it began, unknown to anyone, it began to have a consequence on the tortoise population.
Population, obviously, yeah.
Because for 2 weeks, the tortoises were in distress. They weren't drinking. They weren't eating.
Yeah.
And then after the race, and I'm only using this on my experience in talking with older men and understanding ecology, that they probably loaded all the tortoises into the back of a wagon or back of a pickup truck and drove out to the middle of the desert.
And just let them go.
All in one spot. A tortoise needs about 3 acres to itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they're highly territorial animals.
Who would have thought?
Right. And then we had germs and diseases on our hands.
Yeah.
And the tortoises do not respond well to those.
Yeah.
So as a result, as of this 2019, I can no longer go back to that intersection in spring and have any hope of ever seeing a tortoise cross the road.
Yeah.
Whereas in the 1960s, that was a really great place.
You would just see them.
I would just see them.
Wow.
The other thing that I did as a child is I had to walk home mm-hmm. a mile a day.
A mile a day.
All your listeners are saying, I had to do that too.
Snow and up a hill.
Exactly.
Over train tracks.
But I was 8 years old.
Yeah. Were you by yourself?
I was by myself on a dirt road walking through a creosote bush forest. It's also known as chaparral or as greasewood.
Okay.
And that's all I saw on that mile home down that dusty road was just these trees for a mile. So I had to mentally pace myself every day to walk down that road when the school bus let me off by myself.
Yeah.
I take that walk as the reason why I am the person I am today. It gave me a mental strength. It gave me an inner pool.
A mile.
That I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
The creosote bush is one of the oldest living plants in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
There are several plants. The oldest one they have found is 11,000 years old, and it's in San Bernardino County.
Oh, wow.
And it's just north of Landers, California.
Okay.
Now, Landers, California is also another documentation on why that area is the center of the universe.
Talk about it.
There was a gentleman by the name of George Van Tassel,
mm-hmm.
who thought that that would be a great place to contact UFOs, to find the extraterrestrials.
Okay.
And he'd been given a clue that they may have the spot. Before 2006 or 8, there was this boulder next to Landers that was the largest freestanding boulder in the world. In other words, it wasn't attached to any mountain. It was just this boulder.
It was just there.
It was just there. So George asked this man by the name of Frank Kritzer mm-hmm. to live there and start developing the UFO contact. So he built a home underneath this giant boulder. And that's how they begin to have their contact with aliens and UFOs.
Is there any kind of idea that maybe the aliens put that boulder there?
Yes, because the Native Americans believe that that was specifically put there for a reason. There is history of Native Americans in the area of actually going to that place to worship. Because if you think about what's called the Upper High Desert,
mm-hmm.
it's a real serene place.
Mm-hmm.
There's no noise. There's no civilization.
Mm-hmm.
It's out in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this boulder out in the middle of nowhere.
How did it get there?
You have the oldest living plant out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
So they built these equipment and these concepts to see if they could get in contact with, mm-hmm. with the UFO. And if one is to go to Landers, they could read about the UFO history.
Is this kind of any inspiration for Close Encounters with the Third Kind, maybe?
Well, you think of Devil's Tower.
Okay.
That's out in the middle
yeah.
of nowhere. This rock is out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
It was the largest freestanding boulder until part of it fell off.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately, spiritualists from all around the world claimed a significance to that rock calving off.
Breaking, yeah.
Breaking. And there's a lot of a significance to that.
Okay.
So the alien culture is being propelled as a myth in Joshua Tree. Now, kids are very susceptible for what parents would tell them. For example, my mom, when she went to high school, had a significant knee injury.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived in Mount Shasta, California. And there wasn't hardly any medical facilities. So when they worked on her knee, they gave her a massive scar that looked like a centipede.
Wow.
So every time we asked my mom where she got that scar, she'd say, well, that's a centipede bite. A centipede gave me all that bite. So it scared us from not picking up centipedes,
yeah.
not picking up tarantulas,
yeah.
not picking up scorpions.
Please don't.
Or worst of all, the tarantula wasp. It was the scariest insect in the center of the universe.
Did you ever see any of that on your walk home?
No. We had this massive shade tree in the middle of the ranch.
Okay.
Right next to the cactus garden that can still be seen from space. It has this big, huge rock ring around it that at one time was full of all types of cactus.
Mm.
And when you Google Earth, the ranch, all you can see left is the round ring of rocks. The big massive tree is gone. But when it pollinated, it would bring in every flying insect, including the tarantula wasp. Now, if you're familiar with Costa Rica frogs, they have really bizarre colors.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why they have those colors?
To alert other predators that you can't eat them.
Because
I'm in the first grade.
Because they're poisonous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the tarantula wasp has a bright orange wings, the color of your T-shirt.
Oh, my goodness.
Giving a warning to everybody. Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
I'm poisonous.
I'm poisonous. So when they would fly around, and we'd have our mason jars, our little lids, trying to catch these insects.
Of course.
Because we've been watching, you know, Mutual of Omaha and all these little science movies in class about collecting insects.
Yeah.
But when that wasp came, we'd put the jar and we would run away, saying, you know, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a myth.
Yeah.
The grapefruit that I gave you that mm-hmm. came from my trees, they fly around it all the time.
Yeah.
And they do not bother me. They have no reason to attack me. They just fly around looking for food like everybody else.
Yeah.
But they just tell us, don't touch me. Don't pick me up because my sting is going to really, really hurt.
I'm doing you a favor.
Yeah, I'm doing you a favor.
Wow. Do you want to talk a little bit more about how you ended up growing up And growing out of the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the 1960s, the Vietnam War was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, young men training to fight, die in Vietnam, mm-hmm. were flying over our ranch mm-hmm. in large squadrons of helicopters. They'd be flying over our ranch because our ranch was in direct path between 29 Palms and Camp Pendleton.
Mm-hmm.
And twice a day, if we got onto the major highway from 29 Palms to Palm Springs, would be convoy of Marine trucks, 10 to 25 vehicles long.
Mm.
And my father began to feel sorry for these young men. He would meet their parents, like in the taverns in Joshua Tree. Maybe some of them had lost their sons in the war.
Mm-hmm.
There was no bus system from 29 Palms to Palm Springs. There was no Greyhound bus system. So mm-hmm. as a Marine, you either caught a ride, or you had a buddy, or you hitchhike.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad would pick up the hitchhikers.
Oh, wow.
He'd bring them to the ranch. He would feed them, give them a place to sleep, and then tell them the next day that he would go down to Palm Springs and give them a ride.
Yeah.
The reason that my father had the ability to do that is that he was injured in a plumbing accident. He was, the code at that time were cast iron plumbing trees underneath houses,
mm-hmm.
and he went to move that, and he slipped 3 discs. So he was no longer able to work,
mm-hmm.
and he was basically a stay-at-home dad while my mom went to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason that I had to walk home every day from the school bus stop, mm-hmm. is that my dad couldn't get in the vehicle to drive to pick me up,
mm-hmm.
and my mom was working.
Work. Yeah.
And so people had told my dad that, maybe you need to go to Social Security and see if they'll give you a disability. So he had a surgery, and in the 60s, back surgery was real primitive, and it didn't work. He still was in intense pain. He still couldn't work. No one would hire him.
Mm-hmm.
So he began to take Social Security to court, because in the 60s, you were only disabled if you were missing a limb,
mm-hmm.
if you were confined to a wheelchair, or if you had polio.
Yeah.
If you did not have those three things, you were not disabled. So my father became really frustrated with the government, with the Vietnam War, with the court case that that was going on. And in particular, the year 1968.
Okay.
I heard a newscast the other day say that right now, our nation is in a great turmoil, that people are ready to burst. I don't see that. But as a young child, I saw that on TV in 1968. We had college riots. We had the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And I can specifically remember the assassination of Robert Kennedy Jr.
Yeah.
My parents were really depending upon him to help them because my parents didn't have food stamps.
Yeah.
They didn't have any assistance at all. They were on their own as a handicapped person. And they were thinking, as the nation as a whole, that Robert Kennedy was going to bring our nation hope again.
Right.
It was during the California primaries, and we were all sleeping in, and my mom got up to go make coffee, and she turned the TV on. And she let out a really horrid scream.
Oh, my gosh.
As a child, you remember bizarre behavior that your parents do.
Yeah.
And she come running, screaming in. They shot him. They shot him. They shot him. They were so dependent upon him of helping them out.
Yeah.
That it really frustrated my father. Now, my father is the purest definition of a redneck. He has no political bent, no liberal bent. He has nothing but to be a pure redneck. But at that one point in his life, he decided he was going to change. And that change came through a television show called The Smothers Brothers. The Smothers Brothers are the reason that we were able to have the comedy that we have today.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they were always pushing the envelope
on
what they could do on TV. And it was the election, and it was the war, and it was the college students protesting that in 1969, we actually had soldiers kill college students because of that riot. So the nation was just boiling up, really getting angry.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, and I realized this yesterday, I was doing research, stopped watching Bonanza. He stopped watching the Cartwrights, who had it made, who through hard work and diligence provided for their family.
Mm-hmm.
My father couldn't do that. He couldn't provide for his family. So he watched The Smothers Brothers. Mm-hmm. 1968 became the year of the absurd candidates. Disney put Winnie the Pooh up for president. Charles Schulz put Snoopy up for president. Mad Magazine put Alfred Newman for president. Walt Kelly put Pogo up for president.
Oh my
gosh. You can find posters, still find these posters on the internet for them. Well, the Smothers Brothers put up Pat Paulson for president. And Pat Paulson would go on there and give this speech, and they would talk and present about that. And my dad, in his anger against the government and against the system, and this is the only time he did it in his entire life, took a railing from out of the house that looked like peace symbols attached to each other, took a red can of spray paint it on the passenger side of these multiple symbols.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, spray painted Pat Paulson for president. So he drove around in Joshua Tree and Yucca Valley with this sign. Well, one of the ways that he could earn money was to go to Riverside, California, and pick up produce at the wholesale produce lot. There mm-hmm. was a store in town that would take orders for people who wanted tomatoes for canning or peaches for canning. And so he would drive down and pick that stuff, that produce.
And deliver it.
And then deliver it to the store, and they would deliver it. I got to go with him one time. And what I remember is driving through is that people were standing up and clapping as he slowly drove through. They were cheering and clapping that he had put Pat Paulson for president on the side of his truck because the nation was so at rest, so mad that the relief they had is that, yeah, Pat Paulson for president.
Yeah.
And they were standing up and clapping and giving him the thumbs up. And I remember that to this day. And it was just like, wow, my dad is causing these people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The Smothers Brothers is causing the nation to come together and to rally mm-hmm. around something, you know, very specific.
There are so many other kind of agents and actors in that time, too, that also connect back to the center of the universe for you. Do you want to talk a little bit more about them and those folks, different musicians, different actors there?
Well, the list of musicians that I gave you, they arrived after I did.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Lloyd Wright had built a complex that was his largest collection of buildings in the world. It was called the Metaphysics Center. My father visited that Metaphysics Center because he had heard it was part of an inner healing system. So he went out there to try to use his internal energy to heal his pain and to gain his strength.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone that drives to Joshua Tree passes this metaphysics center. So Frank Lloyd Wright had built that metaphysics center as the portal to your interbeing.
Mm.
That was his goal with his son, was to build that. And so the struggle that my father had is, you know, what do I do? Well, on July 1st, my dad got noticed that we needed to move off the ranch. And so all of a sudden, this ranch that gave us goat's milk, pork, eggs, was gone. So we had to move to a little tiny subdivision and wait for the court.
Yeah.
Well, in January 1969, the judge said, "This man is disabled, and you will pay him the day he walked off the job."
Wow, so back.
Payback.
Back pay for the disability.
An enormous amount of money that he bought a pickup, bought a Travel Queen camper, which was the top of the line campers, and a large utility trailer. And in April of 1969, he packed us all up and headed us towards Oregon,
mm-hmm.
which was a place that could facilitate where he could provide for his family.
Wow.
3 days later, the Smothers Brothers were canceled. And CBS said, "You can no longer be on TV." So they took CBS to court. And they got a huge settlement.
Oh, my gosh.
And a rewrite on the particular show. So we arrive in Oregon. And on July 20th, 1969, I'm hoping that something happens to the space moon mm-hmm. drop. Because I'd really like for them to land on my birthday.
That would be very special.
But they didn't. So neither I nor Tom Hanks ever made it to the moon.
Wow. I mean, Curtis, that's really special, really, really unique. Can you talk a little bit more? How were you able to connect to Oregon and then your kind of transcendence into adulthood and what the center of the universe means for you now?
Oregon was 100% different. Children work in the fields. You pick green beans, you pick strawberries. It builds character. It builds the idea that you can provide for yourself. So my two sisters and myself, we have the character to work hard and prepare for our family. But it robbed your childhood. In the 60s and the 70s, there was no childhood in Oregon in the summertime. You worked all summer and then you went to school. The laws have changed now. Children are allowed to work in the fields. So I feel that with my background, with what I did in the desert in Oregon, it's able to allow me to build into a better person, into a better character, and to understand what it takes to provide for your family, what it takes to be a citizen of this nation.
Yeah.
Oregon is not a static country like the desert.
Yeah.
Here, it's just real static. Nothing really happens because there isn't a whole lot of opportunity to do a lot of activities.
Yeah. There's so many environmental factors that contribute to that as well. Yeah, it's definitely hard to make a living. Where, like you said, it's very open.
Right.
It's very, or like they say about Arizona, it's a dry heat. So,
And one of the things when you talk to adults in Oregon is they say that we are endangering our civilization by not allowing children to work because they're not out there, you know, participating. Whether that's true or not. For example, the Mojave tortoise is on the endangered species list, and there's a lot of reasons to why that is, to the disease, being run over by vehicles. Mm-hmm. But scientists have discovered that it's actually the encroachment of civilization upon the desert that is causing ravens to live. Ravens are unnatural to the desert, and they love to eat hatchling tortoises.
Mm-hmm.
In the same manner we see on TV of the sea tortoises,
yeah,
have thousands of eggs
and the seagulls.
Because they can do the seagulls. Yeah. The ravens are doing to that.
Wow.
So when our childhoods are disappearing of the people who are senior citizens, we see it as kind of an encroachment that really there's only one significant reason to why things are going the way they are is because we've taken away childhood. We've taken away the ability for kids to grow and mature into adults, and they're no longer having that responsibility.
I see. Curtis, we're closing in on our time here together. Anything else that you would like to share or how you would like to be remembered to go ahead and put out there?
Well, I'd like to be remembered as a person, as a child who used the desert as a playground. And understood the resources that were available, and that I saw the nation try to rebirth itself by being out there and seeing it, you know, every day, and that walking a mile by yourself through a barren land is actually a healthy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you strength. That when I talk to young adults, they don't walk. They don't have to put themselves through a difficult situation, with, you know, without their choice.
Mm-hmm.
Our grandson, he's 23 years old. He's had 8 different jobs because he doesn't like it. From the time I was 18 to 30, I only had 2 jobs. You just stick with it and you do it because that's what the road I had to walk on every day. You just stick with it. You put one foot in front of the other, whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable. You know, you do it.
Thank you so much, Curtis. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you today.
You're welcome.